Welcome to the History Slam podcast from ActiveHistory.ca. Here's your host, Sean Graham.
Thank you, Adam. Welcome to History Slam, everybody. I am Sean Graham coming at you today nearly live. We are in Ottawa, Ontario. It is Congress 2015 and the Canadian Historical Association annual meeting, and this is where people bring new, fun, exciting projects, and we're here with someone who has done that this year. It's Tara Brookfield from Wilfrid Laurier University, the Brantford campus, part of History and Children's Studies. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Sean.
So we actually earlier today had Laura Campbell on, and you were a contributor to that book. So people who have listened to that episode will be familiar with the War Resisters book. And your entry in that, I have to say, one of the cooler titles in the book. It's The Fasting Granny versus the Trudeau Government. That's part of the Worth Fighting For book. And your other book is Cold War Comforts, Canadian Women, Child Safety, and Global Insecurity, which was published in 2012. So in general, would you say that you are obviously a scholar of the Cold War period, but a scholar of the domestic situation in the Cold War and resistance to the Cold War? Is that sort of your main focus?
Well, I just came from a panel where everyone was talking about how historians today are hyphenated,
yeah.
That we are no longer just a social historian or just a political historian, but
yeah.
I like to say that I'm a historian of Cold War Canada,
mm-hmm.
looking at how ordinary citizens responded to Cold War fears and threats, sometimes in Canada or sometimes those who would take their activism overseas to sites of Cold War conflict.
Mm-hmm.
But both my book and the piece in the War Resisters book look specifically at women's resistance, and so gender plays a big part in how I examine Cold War Canada.
Mm-hmm. And Laura and I were talking about this earlier, this notion of resistance as being seen sometimes as a feminine thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, war is masculine, resisting war is feminine. And so these are the sorts of dynamics that you're looking into. But I'm intrigued by the other part of the subtitle of Cold War Canada, which is child safety.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we often, I think there's, again, this perception of child safety as being a feminine thing. It's very a maternal instinct to protect the children. And, you know, how does the child safety element play into all this gendered approach?
Mm-hmm. Well, it wasn't something I expected to find. From my MA research, I had done work on Canadian women's politicization during the First World War, and looking at particularly how Montreal suffragists conceptualized maternal feminism and egalitarian feminism in the First World War, and how the campaign really divided people who had different sort of understandings of womanhood at the time. And I thought, by the time I get to Cold War research, that would be an old-fashioned way of women's activism, that defining your right, for example, to have the vote or to be conceptualized as a citizen would become because of your maternalistic values or your concern for children's issues. I thought that would all be done and women wouldn't be presenting that as a part of their activism in the post-war period. But it turned out, whether I was studying sort of more right-leaning women who are concerned about civil defense and building bomb shelters in their backyards, or more left-leaning peace activists, both of them were using sort of children as the discourse for describing why they got involved and that they were concerned for their children's livelihood should a nuclear war come to Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And that extended to the other women I looked at who were concerned for the lives of children in different Cold War conflicts, be it Civil War Greece,
mm-hmm.
Hong Kong after the Chinese Revolution or the Vietnam War. So all these women were using the same language of children's safety as both, I guess, a reason why they were getting personally mobilized. And this included a lot of women who had never been active before,
mm-hmm.
that it was concerns about radiation in the air or a new type of war coming to Canada or in other sites that were prompting them because of children's vulnerability,
mm-hmm.
which also came out of the Second World War, how many children victims there were in the Second World War. At the same time, though, I think it was also a tactic of women knowing that that was in some ways a recognized way for women to enter masculine spaces,
mm-hmm.
diplomacy, defense talks, that they could come and have a seat at the table and be looked at as being respectable and give them a voice where they might have otherwise been shut down. So I think it was both a way to cloak their radical ideas at times,
mm-hmm.
and be taken, if not taken seriously, at least have their voice heard, but also was a genuine concern for children's health and welfare in this era.
That's interesting, this idea of legitimacy,
mm-hmm.
because the stereotype is the Mrs. Lovejoy screaming, mm-hmm. you know, won't yeah. somebody think of the children,
exactly.
right? But these women are actually using it to, like you say, to have a seat at the table to address, I don't want to say more serious issues, but issues that otherwise they would not have access to.
Right. I think at the time, you know, even though we're, at the time it was sort of 40 years after suffrage,
right.
we still see very few women in positions of political power, minister positions, cabinet positions, and in sort of the key issues that were affecting the Cold War, be it military, defense, civil defense, those things were not necessarily, they were using women's labor to put forward a lot of the causes, but they weren't using women to design the ideology or to criticize it, to improve it. So I think, again, it was a genuine concern. People were really worried about new weaponry, new types of warfare that were going to impact children and had impacted children. But also it was a way that they could use their expertise as mothers, as people in professions, nurses, teaching, social workers, and sort of feminized professions, where they could say, we are the experts on the subject, and therefore we should be recognized as having a say in the dialogue.
And is that something that men ever did, is use children to talk about their policies? And I mean, because there's a joke amongst sports writers that whenever somebody retires to say they want to spend more time with their family,
mm-hmm.
they go home and in 2 weeks realize that they don't actually want to spend more time with their family. So it's these athletes who want to get back on the road and really get away from their family. So it strikes me that this idea of talking about children's safety would be a very female domain.
Mm-hmm.
But is this something that men could talk about too? Because, I mean, men have kids. Mm-hmm. Men don't want their kids to die.
Of course.
But is that something that that you found any men who are using similar similar language in discussing these issues?
Well, certainly in sort of the mixed gender peace organizations, that was a dialogue that was coming through from all the members. I think it was always coming more strongly from women, particularly in the single gender organizations like the Voice of Women or previously the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, as well as the first disarmament group started as sort of mothers' groups concerned about radiation and milk and things that were particularly affecting their lives as homemakers. We do see someone very prominent activist, someone like Dr. Benjamin Spock, a pediatrician who was considered, you know, the Bible of childcare, who mothers and families would turn to, who became quite a radical peace activist, both in terms of the broader nuclear disarmament movement, but also the anti-Vietnam War movement.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was someone who was sort of known for children's safety in sort of peacetime, who was also concerned about sort of young people's bodies being destroyed by militarism and war.
Mm-hmm.
But in some ways, he's an exception. Most other physicians who were heavily involved, for example, in the anti-war movement, presented themselves as experts coming from their medical expertise.
Mm-hmm.
We see a lot of male clergy who and other spiritual leaders, but they would position themselves because of their profession. So I see men less so making it the mainstream part of their discourse.
Right.
And of course, men were worried about the same issues as women, but
mm-hmm.
often men activists in this period were particularly defining themselves by their specific groups that they were
right.
representing, other identities they had beyond being fathers.
Hmm. And is that just reflective of the period that women then would be pigeonholed in a way that men are not? I mean, you know, if women are sort of labeled as, well, they're mothers and that's
mm-hmm.
it. I mean, whereas men, they're fathers, but they're this, and this, right? I mean, that, is
right.
that just reflective of the patriarchal society of the second half of the 20th century?
Right, and that's why I was surprised there wasn't a bit more progress by then. That I was finding women
right.
constantly referring back to children. And I think part of it has to do with how much surveillance there was against peace activists.
Mm.
That and considerable, I guess, persecution in certain cases. That when, for example, a group like the Voice of Women came on the scene, they were quite comfortable in using their middle class status and their identity as mothers to say, don't worry about us, we're not political, even though of course they were,
mm-hmm.
But you can trust in us because we're mothers. And so I think they used the respectability of motherhood to do very disrespectful things at times.
Right.
I mean, there were arrests, they were very radical in many
mm-hmm.
ways, but initially, especially in presenting themselves to the government and to the different political parties, their respectability came from their class and it came from their identity as mothers.
So in a lot of ways, they're politicizing their role as mothers.
Yes, absolutely.
Right? They're taking it. It's not a domestic thing.
Mm-hmm.
They're making it very public and very active in that way, which is a stark difference from, you think of a mother as, she takes care of you when you're sick, when you're right. 5 years old, right? But they're really using that almost to their advantage.
Yes, and again, I think it was a deliberate tactic, but I think it was mothers become politicized when things that are entering their realm are concerning them. So when there's a long history, this is not unique to peace activism. It's very much involved in, let's say, anything to do with consumer movements, to do with labor movements, where it comes down to seeing children's bodies as a way to gain an audience. Also, I think one thing I haven't mentioned is that the Reverend Lovejoy's wife, the Think of the Children, it's because that is a catchy media message. That if you say something is threatening our children, particularly by the middle of the 20th century, where the idea of childhood is one of innocence and one of protection, and that children have this very specific vulnerability that is acknowledged. They're no longer working in the same way. They're part of a family in a different way. That suddenly this is a very valuable tool to get media attention. So a lot of the women I studied on both sides, again, those who were much more conservative, those who were much more radical, know that to get media attention and to get their cause forward is to place children at the front of the dialogue.
And, we like to joke on this show that we do it for the kids.
Of course. We always do it for the kids. That's why I'm here, for the kids.
That's right, we do it for the kids. So moving forward, so you've continued to look at war resistance or peace activists, and the project that you discussed on Monday in your presentation was entitled 31 Hours on Grindstone Island, a Fraught Experiment in Nonviolence. Now, Grindstone Island, there are a couple of these in Canada. You're discussing the one in Ontario that is about, 72 kilometers from here is what Google told me, southwest of where we sit.
That's right.
In Ottawa.
So this is Grindstone Island on Big Rideau Lake, which is approximately 70 kilometers from Ottawa, 50 kilometers from Kingston. And I get excited when I see Grindstone Island, and it turns out to be one of the many others in Canada or the U.S.
Right.
But this is a private island that was formerly the home of the Kingsmill family, sort of a wealthy elite family who first made it a summer home in 1916. And the patriarch of that family was Canada's first admiral, and it was where the family would summer.
And it's not... I mean, it's big, but it's not huge, right? I mean, the thing I saw said about 11 acres of land.
That's right. So about 11 acres of land. And at the time that I'm looking at it, about half of that was untamed. It was just brush. And the other part had a sort of a grand house on it and about 11 other buildings, boathouse, smaller cottages, large, nice garden, tennis court, and a waterfront.
Well, so how did it end up with the Kingsmill family?
Well, its previous life was a quarry, and so at some point it was no longer being used for that, and it must have gone up for private sale, and it's in a region that is part of sort of the boom in cottages.
Right.
So I think they came from sort of that early wilderness tourism in Canada where people would want to leave the urban, industrialized, and for the case of Admiral Kingsmill, probably, the militarized sort of life, and have a bit of a retreat where they could recover. And it was close enough to Ottawa that a lot of Kingsmill's friends in the government, Prime Minister Borden visited, for example, other Ottawa elite and from the UK as well would come to have this sort of lovely summer home. And most of the other cottages in the area were also for other privileged families at the time. There was a ferry that they could take there, and someone described it as sort of, at one point, very much of a Great Gatsby lifestyle of parties and sport and just in a beautiful location.
So, but just logistically, you mentioned that there was a ferry. So how far off, how far from the shoreline is this island? Is it far enough that, they couldn't just take a little motorboat of their own or a canoe or something, that they needed a ferry? I mean, the logistics of that I find kind of interesting.
Right. So what I have heard, I have yet to be to the island myself, but it was a ferry from Portland, Ontario, that would serve the other cottages in the area, which were on both the shoreline and other little small islands around the area. So they would, I think it was about a half an hour from Portland on the ferry. And the Kingsmills did have, in the early days, they didn't have motorboats. They had canoes and other things, sailboats. But later on, there was a motorboat that you could operate privately. And eventually, the cottage era sort of just wasn't in its same sort of point to warrant a ferry. So by the late 80s, there was only sort of private transportation.
Okay. So over time, the island, it goes to his daughter. Diana Kingsmill Wright. And who was she? She's obviously influential in this story. So who was she? What was her background?
She is fascinating. Growing up in this elite family, she was quite sort of known as sort of a socialite's daughter. She came out in the way that debutantes would come out in big families. She married sort of a distant member of the royal family, her first husband. She was on the the first woman on the Olympic ski team. Like, she had this sort of fascinating life that is worthy of another conversation. Her first marriage ended, and she later remarried Jim Wright, who was sort of a prairie socialist from out west. And her life changed at that point. She was living in rural Saskatchewan, supporting a lot of the farmers' movements out there, the labor movement, and got very active in the peace movement. So when her mother passed away in 1956, the children, Diana and her two brothers, inherited the island. And none of them were living near sort of Ottawa or Kingston anymore, so it wasn't something that they were going to use with their own families. Mm. And it just seemed something that, you know, they could keep but use every once in a while. And Diana thought, like, it's a great space. Could it not be used for educational purposes? Mm. Could we not give it and donate it? So for several years, it was discussed and nothing happened. And eventually, she was able to, in my understanding, buy out her brother's share. Mm. And then it was between her and her son, who was a student journalist at the University of Ottawa, also had very much interests in sort of peace activism and internationalism. And together, they began to look at people who might want to operate it. And they approached several universities, thinking it could be a student retreat. And eventually, Diana reconnected with one of her old friends, Murray Thompson, who was a Quaker and member of the Canadian Friends Service Committee Peace Education Department. And they talked, and he said, that would be great. I think we could do something with it. So Diana ended up renting it out to the Quakers in 1963 for $1 a year, with hope that the Quakers would turn it into a peace institute, the idea that people could come to the island and be immersed in this beautiful location, get away from it all, and use the space on the island to work towards peace education, peace research.
And how did that work out?
Worked phenomenally well. It was, I mean, people could meet at conference centers and hotels, they could meet at universities, but there was quite intriguing idea to be able to have, in some ways, a mini vacation, along with being able to immerse yourselves in this sort of peaceful community. So. Right. In the first 3 years of operation, it was highly successful. People came from all over Canada and the United States. Mm. They could host about 50 guests at one time.
Oh, wow.
And they would run from basically from May to September. And the Quakers themselves would organize several workshops and other programs related to international relations, Canada and Quebec relations, disarmament. And then they would also open it up other weeks for other like-minded groups. So the Canadian Peace Research Institute had a peace school that they would run for 2 weeks every summer with international students, with professors from sort of around the world would come. And then they also would run a nonviolent training institute, which was what the topic of my paper at Congress was. The Voice of Women would come to do different workshops. There was later on a high school workshop for high school students to come and spend 2 weeks to immerse in this issue. So it was very successful. Yeah. In the 60s up to the mid-70s, when they ran into some financial difficulties, went through some transformations, and ended up being a cooperative movement afterwards, and ran until 1991 doing peace and social justice programs in the 1980s.
Wow. So that's a pretty good legacy, to get 30 years out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm wondering, you talk about that they set up these things for people to come. I mean, but who's coming?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the social context of the 1960s is that you have people on the left who are staunchly anti-war.
Mm-hmm.
Is that their market, or are they looking at people who are maybe undecided or more middle Canadians who they're trying to show a non-violent lifestyle to sort of further the cause?
Well, they tried to do it all. Some parts of the summer would be a moment for people in both Canada and the U.S., and I was really surprised at how many Americans came to Grindstone. Initially, I assumed it would be more of a Canadian movement, but we really see within the peace activist community the border not having as much meaning at times. People were in conversation with each other and would be advertising events like this around North America, and Canadians would go to the States and vice versa. And sometimes Canada was seen as a special space where Americans could get away from some of the more intimidating aspects that they were facing there. rightly or wrongly, some of them, people I've interviewed, talk about Canada being a haven for activists at that time. So they had big names like Tom Hayden. They had lots of people in sort of Martin Luther King circle come. Civil rights was very much sort of part of the dialogue at the time. And so this is where people could come and reflect and retreat and learn from each other, but they were in some ways like-minded. Then they also tried to have sessions that would introduce these to people who were, they hope, would be decision makers.
Right.
So that one of the interesting things they did was a diplomats conference where they would invite people from the embassies in Ottawa from both sides of the Iron Curtain to come and spend a weekend at Grindstone, a week at Grindstone, and really try and work out some conflict resolution issues. And the idea was that because they had to live on the island, that this would be not just happening in the formal workshops or the agenda, the 9 o'clock to 5 o'clock sessions, but they'd be washing dishes together, they'd be playing volleyball together, they'd be swimming together, and hopefully leave with a better understanding of not only their own internal differences, but what the broader peace movement was trying to achieve.
So it's really creating a community.
Absolutely.
More so than any sort of formal negotiations or formal anything. It's just, you know, if you like people, you're not going to get into a fight with them.
Exactly. And they say the conversations on the veranda of the main house was really where things happened.
Right.
These informal things, you know, a little bit of wine, a little bit of music. This is where people would build relationships that they hoped then would take back to their workplaces. Mm-hmm. And they did the same for journalists, for teachers. There was sort of an interfaith seminar every year, so these opportunities for people to live together temporarily.
I noticed in the title you talk about nonviolence and as opposed to necessarily anti-war.
Right.
So and you talk about the Civil Rights Movement, and Martin Luther King in the Civil Rights Movement was very much a proponent of nonviolence. Mm-hmm. So they're looking at, it's not a strictly anti-war movement, it's violence in all its forms that they're trying to eliminate or reduce.
Yes, I mean, the Quakers are known particularly for their anti-war activism since sort of the 17th century, but they're looking at violence in all forms. They're concerned about decolonization, they're concerned about poverty, they're concerned about sort of feminist issues at this time, environmental issues, and how nonviolence could inform those movements, those causes. So what I was speaking to about Congress this week was their training in nonviolence institutes that they had, where they would bring activists in different causes together. And the idea was that they might need some experience in presenting nonviolent resistance. Mm-hmm. So for the first summer they had this, they practiced being dragged away by police. So they had some of the participants pretend to be police who would be arresting people, and they literally would drive people across the island and see what, you know, what's the best way to hold your body. Mm. What does it feel like emotionally, physically? And many of those activists later, then the following summer, were at the Lama Kazaa protests in Quebec around around the nuclear sort of weapons being produced there. And they said, I had had that experience before I had to resist arrest for real. Grindstone gave me the opportunity to practice those tactics.
Right.
I also talk about two more less tame, nonviolent training institutes, one in which they had a mock invasion of the island.
Wow.
And this is part of, I guess, a phenomenon called sociodramas, which is part of sort of experimental learning that was popular amongst psychologists and other social scientists, the idea that you could role play your activism or your education and allow people to pretend, and therefore you could actually experience it rather than just pontificate about it. And so they had 51 participants and 65 for the mock invasion. Six people were designated as the aggressors. They would be known as the Unionists, who were part of a new right-wing government in the aftermath of Quebec separation, who were coming to occupy Grindstone Island. The rest of the participants were to respond to this occupation nonviolently. So no guerrilla warfare, but no complete submission either. How could they express themselves while keeping their morals intact? And then they had another six participants who were umpires, who were transcribing everything. We have the transcripts from this experiment that was supposed to go on for 4 days. Mm-hmm. But as the title of my paper noted, it only lasted for 31 hours. In the end, it was deemed in some ways a failure for nonviolence because 13 of the participants were killed, I'm using in quotation marks.
Right.
Their resistance of ringing a bell, which they had been warned not to do by the occupiers, resulted in the unionist shooting and gassing the participants. And they were carrying real unloaded weapons, and they had bricks in paper bags to simulate gas attacks. They had gas masks on it. So it's trying to bring people into a situation that they might confront, particularly in the civil rights movement, but also in the anti-war movement or in other circumstances, and see how would you react. And for the activists who were participating, and there was this five-day debrief afterwards, they really learned their own internal organization was problematic. They weren't listening to each other. There was sort of an anarchist element that was dominating. They couldn't decide their what they would do to organize. Others felt that nonviolence should be expressed more through love and Gandhian attitudes, and so they realized sometimes some of their challenges were their own diversity of political identities and definitions of what nonviolence meant.
The title of the piece was a fraught experiment. So obviously the failure of it, if it's intended for 4 days, only goes 31 hours. But I get the sense from you that the lessons learned were actually quite successful.
Right. So in the moment, it was considered a failure because they weren't able to achieve, and people were highly distraught over the outcomes, in feeling that pacifists had lost, but also just personally shaken up by the whole experience.
Right.
But in the debrief that followed, as well as a published report that came out a year later that was widely circulated amongst Quakers as well as academics, the lessons learned was to think about group dynamics in particular. What obstacles would people face? And of course, there was recognition that this was a contrived situation, that no one was in danger, and people admitted they probably acted more radically because they knew they weren't really going to be killed. But there were small lessons to go back to issues of child safety, which is something that interested me. There were six young children that in this activity because they had come with their parents. So children are running around, and some of them are into it, and some of them just want to go swimming. And one of the tactics that a group projected was to have a hunger strike because the unionists said, you can't use the main house in the kitchen unless you work for us. So one of the ideas of nonviolent resistance would be a hunger strike. But some of the mothers mentioned, well, will the children have to be a part of that? Will we have to be a part of that? Will still be child, like, caring for our children? Will I be strong enough if I am on a hunger strike for 4 days to still make sure, you know, my child's not going to wander off to the lake or something?
Right.
So having, I think, children present allow them to think of the realities of sacrifices that you have to make. And it's all well and good to think it will end up being the textbook way you think pacifism might play out or nonviolence. But what are the struggles you might have personally amongst your comrades or amongst your family in actually sort of confronting violent?
And that's one of the things, I mean, I've read about the civil rights movement a lot, and that's one of the things that I think it's overlooked, is that it's easy to say, don't fight back. It's really easy to say, but it's much more difficult to do that, particularly in a situation where if one person does it, the whole thing is compromised. Like, you need everyone to be on the same page and to go along with it. And say what you will about the movie Selma, I have certain issues with it, but there's a really good scene where one of the guys goes to get a gun and says, I'm going to go shoot somebody. And the retort is, well, they're going to shoot you back. And he says, I don't care. I'm going to take some of them with me. And then that message of, well, you can't do that, because if you do that, sure, maybe you get whatever you want, but that screws it up for everybody else. And that's the thing of nonviolence, is it really is, it has to be 100% buy-in from everybody. And so these sorts of experiments, if you can make them as real as possible to really challenge people in the moment before it becomes real on the streets or wherever you're protesting, usually on a street somewhere, that's really useful. And you want to test people, and you want to push them to their limits to really get a sense of how it might play out. And so over time, I mean, you mentioned initially there was this disappointment. Over time, is there a recognition of these participants that they had actually really probably achieved something much greater than if it had been, quote unquote, successful at the time?
I think so. I mean, some were concerned about making the experiment go public because it might be read as, well, it's impossible to have a nonviolent resistance. If there's people with guns, they're always going to win.
Right.
So I think some people are saying, no, it's going to hurt our cause to put it forward. Other people thought, no, this is really important, the lessons learned to understand the internal difficulties. Although I wouldn't say that there was either in these experimental learning situations or in other workshops, there was acknowledgement that not everyone defined nonviolence in the same way. Mm. That, for example, some people might think raising your voice in a discussion is violent. Others right. would feel that sabotage is appropriate in certain, and there was different degrees. And I think particularly in some of the intergenerational moments where some of the younger crowd at Grindstone, and it was always very intergenerational, in addition to little kids running around, there was different generations of activists present and working together. Some of the younger people coming of age in the 1960s and 70s were more Marxist and thought maybe a revolution needed to take place either in Canada or other situations. Mm-hmm. And could there be some forms of violence, such as genocide, that required a violent response?
Right.
For the Quakers who come from a pacifist sort of standpoint where no violence is appropriate, mm-hmm. that would cause tensions and discussions. But I think the importance of Grindstone was it gave a space for these ideas to be discussed mm-hmm. and taken away from in either traditional learning situations or these experiments where the research and education element, I think, made it really important and differentiated Grindstone from the rest of the peace movement in Canada at the time, which was much more about civic engagement and government lobbying, big marches, big public spectacles. That Grindstone was part of the peace movement, but was more about the importance of education and research to achieve their long-term goals for social change.
Yeah. And you mentioned the Quaker aspect of this, which is fascinating because at least my conception of Quakers is in Pennsylvania during the American Revolution mm-hmm. saying, you know, no, we're good,
mm-hmm.
right? And everyone's saying, okay, that's quaint, that's cute, mm-hmm. good for them. But the fact that here we are in the 1960s and there's this Quaker contingent doing this, I mean, mm-hmm. What is the Quaker population in Canada? How mm-hmm. significant is it? And then two, were they seen as a serious entity, or was this notion of, well, like this idea that, well, they're marginal, they're not that important, mm-hmm. so who really cares, from official bodies? So yeah, I'm just wondering what the reaction is to Quakers and what their presence is.
Right. Well, I don't have numbers off the top of my head, but they're, mm-hmm. you know, they're a minority within Canada in terms mm-hmm. of other Christian groups. But I would disagree that they are quaint. I think, mm-hmm. while there is certainly that element of some of the Quaker faith that maybe is viewed as old-fashioned in terms of some of the language used or maybe the way that they practice some of their faith. I think Quakers have been radical for a long time, both as conscientious objectors in which there wasn't sort of a, okay, it's all right that you guys take a side, that they were putting sort of risking losing citizenship or risking being arrested for that
right.
action. A lot of history of civic disobedience. So I think Quakers were recognized as subversive by the Canadian government at time, not only for some of their religious practices, but for being sort of one of the three peace churches who have always sort of been opposing the state calls to war. And I think among peace circles at the time, they were considered a great ally, that they had a long history of this activism, that they had resources and networks across Canada and the United States, certainly, but to Britain and elsewhere, in which something like the draft dodgers, the Quakers were central at mm-hmm. At sort of negotiating safe spaces for draft dodgers to come to Canada. They were central within other peace organizations. They were very much integrative. So there was the Quaker movements themselves, but there was Quakers in other peace groups.
Right.
So they weren't, the word's escaping me, they didn't stick to themselves. Mm. And so Grindstone,
so they weren't isolated.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They were very
yeah.
active and prominent
yeah.
in many circles. And Grindstone is a great case of that, in which in a survey of participants, I think between 63 and 68, certainly there's a large Quaker cohort, but there's also one-third of the people there who had no religious affiliation, as well as Jewish activists, other Christian activists, and sometimes there would be Buddhist guests. And it was a way where people that the Quakers thought they're about, one of the things they could contribute was the space on Grindstone to have these conversations, to practice the values that they were all interested in, even though there was varying degrees of interpretation.
Mm-hmm. Like, that's really cool because, I mean, oftentimes I think in this country we don't think of nonviolence in the same way as you have it in the American context,
mm-hmm.
because in the American context it's so in your face
mm-hmm.
with things like the civil rights movement, whereas in Canada we've had protests and popular movements and that sort
mm-hmm.
of thing, but not to this extent. So that this existed in Canada
mm-hmm.
is really quite fascinating. And for you, what does it tell us about protest movements anti-war movements or and nonviolence just in general, what does it, how does it inform our understanding of these larger movements?
Well, one thing that I already mentioned, how Canadian and American activists worked very closely together in these education and research circles, as well as in other forms of political resistance. So to see how close people were, and I mean, I would talk to people in some cases. I've interviewed about 50 participants from Grindstone, and some of them said, well, I just saw it. I was in a small university in Ohio, and I saw a poster on the wall of my department, and so I went to Grindstone for the summer. I'm like, well, how did that poster get
right,
there?
Yeah.
And through Quaker circles, through peace activist circles, through peace education circles, there was this sort of borderless movement where people were circulating ideas and expertise.
Right.
And so I think it sort of understanding the internationalism as being part of this, the transnationalism being part of it, and what Canadian represented to the American participants, what it meant for Canadians to have this as a space for themselves. And I think it's just offering us a different piece of Canadian peace history. For example, I think we mainly think about the big organizations, usually non-denominational student movements, the groups like the Voice of Women, these sort of big networks who were very much, you know, protesting on Parliament Hill and out in public and in the newspapers. And then we have this more quiet, reflective space where those people would go to recharge, to get inspired, to test themselves. And I think it's this, Grindstone is not in our public memory the same way that I think it could be, in that education and research were central to the peace movement. And there's another organization, the Canadian Peace Research Institute, that was sort of a year-round activity in Dundas, Ontario, as well as Oakville, Ontario, that there were these sort of quiet, more academic centers that in some ways were very traditional academics and in some ways were part of these more experimental learning moments. So I think Grindstone is also part of this alternative education movement that is sort of sweeping United States and Britain at the time, as well as Canada.
But was there, I'm wondering if there was a conflict, ideological conflict. I mean, so much of Canada, the popular narrative is peacekeeping, and certainly there's a great tradition of peacekeeping in this country. But that being said, peacekeepers have guns. Peacekeepers sometimes have to shoot and do stuff. But ultimately, the goal of the peacekeeper is to keep people who don't like each other apart so that there can be a negotiated settlement. But when you're talking about a Quaker nonviolence, they wouldn't want to have guns. They wouldn't, right? They would want to resolve things differently. So with someone like Lester Pearson, who obviously strongly supports peacekeeping, is there a conflict between what's going on Grindstone Island and these larger peacekeeping principles in Canada?
That's a good question. I think it's interesting. I don't see the United Nations coming up as a topic of discussion as much. I see some things like the use of small arms or Canada's sort of role in the world. So it's something I think I need to think more about to see. I mean, I think from a contemporary standpoint, people involved in the peace movement are quite critical of the United Nations. The way that peacekeeping is delivered, in some ways, the under-resourced nature of it, that you can't sort of send unarmed people into a conflict in the middle and expect them to be safe.
Right.
That the safety of Canadian peacekeepers is at risk, and the, I guess, the UN provisions that allows them to operate and it sometimes exercise force is very limited. But they're soldiers. Their job is they're trained to exercise violence as a means of defense for themselves and for the civilians that they're protecting. I think the people at Grindstone would acknowledge that that's not a bad thing, because I think intervention and doing something is important. That Canada can't sit back and let the world succumb to violence.
Right.
I think there was not necessarily, well, there was maybe critique of the state. The anarchist element was small. There was definitely an understanding that we have to work together and that the government is part of that, in which the diplomatic meetings, I think, sort of show the support for the government, the idea that there are people there who can use diplomacy as an important tool that should be out there.
Okay. And on the flip side, is there a distrust of the government of these people? You alluded to, you know, certain surveillance things that are going on, but is there a significant distrust, or is it sort of one of these things that, well, maybe we should just keep our eye on and make sure that nothing too coercive is going on.
Mm-hmm. So I have requested the RCMP files on Grindstone. Yep. I know they have at least 4 entries.
Okay.
I'm in the process of getting the Freedom of Information. Yep. I think I have like 30 days still to wait my request out.
Yes.
So I'm really curious to see what's in there. From my interviews, there's definitely suspicion that there were some people at these seminars and workshops who were just pretending to be there and reporting back to the RCMP.
Right.
I think testing the degree of what is happening on this island. I mean, I can imagine from an RCMP perspective,
mm-hmm.
especially when they're hearing about things like the 31 hours experiment.
Right.
They're a mock invasion. Are they practicing? What's going on? Are they trying to practice a revolution, for example, not understanding the nuances of what they're trying to achieve with nonviolence? So certainly the people I spoke to feel that they were being surveilled, if not always on Grindstone, in their other lives.
Sure, sure. And yeah, because I guess that's the benefit of being on an island, that you are somewhat isolated.
Right.
Right. So it would be harder for there to be RCMP surveillance on the island itself if you're vetting people who are coming out.
Exactly. So at some points they said that person just didn't feel right.
Mm-hmm.
That was he perhaps a government, sort of someone who is going to report back to the government.
Right. And I would assume too, the demographics of this organization, I'm guessing, skewed younger, which would make it harder for the RCMP to pose as younger. But your reaction to that makes me think I'm wrong in assuming that.
I mean, there was definitely a cohort of people who you would imagine would be on Grindstone, both as part of the peace movement or the counterculture.
Yeah.
Young people either coming from universities or recent grads or dropouts. That was definitely a cohort, but there was definitely people who were coming out of a long tradition of peace activism, so it wouldn't be unusual to have a meeting in which there were early people in their early 20s along with people in their 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. You can look at the pictures, and some people talk about, well, we were the gray hairs in the pictures and things like that. And sometimes that worked really well together, and sometimes they talk about, well, you got to turn off the rock and roll music. Now it's getting late. You need to keep the island down.
So you've mentioned a couple of times that you've interviewed some folks who were on Grindstone Island, and you mentioned as well that there are transcripts of some of these experiments. But, you know, otherwise, what sort of documentation, what sort of research methodology would you take for something like this that is clearly a very community organization, and a lot of which would have been discussions, talking?
Mm-hmm.
You know, for as much as you can look at minutes of a meeting, I mean, they don't always tell you exactly what happened, what the discussion was. So, you know, how are you sussing these things out to really get a sense of what it was like on Grindstone?
I've been very fortunate to find not only official sort of Quaker records. The Canadian Friends Service Committee have archival collections about Grindstone. And when Grindstone evolved into a cooperative, the cooperative deposited their own records at the Ontario Archives, which includes the cooperative period as well as the Quaker period. And then there's my interviews. But I've also followed the private collections of people who were activists that visited Grindstone maybe once, maybe twice, and have in some cases have left their notes.
Okay.
So it's amazing that they've kept these sort of scribbles on the back of programs or other things in which they're talking about what so-and-so said and writing their own comments down.
Mm-hmm.
So I have some sense of the official program, some sense of what people were taking at the time, some sense of in the published record what people were saying about Grindstone, and both the Ottawa and the Kingston newspapers have a lot to say about Grindstone, both in terms of concerns about these crazy hippies at Grindstone as well as, you know, very fair reporting about the peace education that was happening there. What I'm still trying to figure out is how to deal with the amount of nostalgia about Grindstone in the reflections, in the written reflections, and in my interviews. A lot of people have a real emotional tie to the space as the land, the physical environment, the relationships that they were built there.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases are a little wary to look critically at their own internal dealings. Others are quite open. That's part of the process, to look internally at the tensions, either financial tensions that they had at times or ideological tensions, and look back on that.
Yeah, that cooperative period would be really interesting, the financial part of that,
right?
I mean, people are really putting their own stake into it, and adding a financial element always adds some tension to it.
Exactly.
And I could see how people would be perhaps a little reluctant to discuss that element of it once it gets into the cooperative period, and how that would be a challenge for you to try and break that down. But, you know, in that respect, are those financial records freely available?
Yes, and they kept everything, which is, well, They kept a lot.
Right.
What happened was in the mid-70s, Diana needed to sell the island. She wanted to use the funds to publish one of her late husband's books. And so they had to figure out, could we still run this and purchase the island from Diana? And mm-hmm. it was decided the Quakers didn't have the financial resources at the time. It was temporarily run for 1 year by the Canadian Peace Research Institute due to a large donation. But then it was decided a cooperative model was more of interest to the people who were committed to the island. And so it transferred to this cooperative movement who had enough money through the program and membership fees to sustain the island. But mm-hmm. why it eventually closed in the early 90s was just the capital investments that you needed to do to bring this home that had been built in 1916
sure.
to maintain it, whether right. it was the sewage or safety reasons that it eventually closed due to lack of funds.
Okay, and now this is according to Wikipedia, mm-hmm. there is archives and museum informatics who use the island. There's summer camps that are on the island. So it's used periodically?
Now, so when the cooperative folded, they had run summer camps in the 1980s, which is right. a whole other topic. They ran these alternative kids camps, sort of non-competitive camps. When they folded it, eventually I think Library and Archives Canada had it very briefly as a conference retreat, and now it's back to being a private cottage.
Okay.
Which, as far as I know, has been open a few times to reunions of old grindstoners coming okay. back to take photos, have a little mini reunion, but it's back to being a private home.
Okay, so someone who clearly could afford to either knock down that house or completely renovate it and bring it up to a 21st century
right.
living
and at
condition.
Least, I mean, I think one of the problem was it was never built to have 50 people on the island
right,
at the same
yeah.
time.
Yeah.
So that wear and tear on mm-hmm. it was significant. And particularly when it was running summer camps in the 1980s, the liability insurance that would be required
right.
to have young people on the island. So as far as I can tell from a photo essay done by Cory Doctorow, who was a person who attended one of the alternative children's camps and then older kids camps in the 1980s, and today he's a well-known young adult author. He went back and did a beautiful photo essay, and they've kept the old buildings, they've kept the graffiti in the bunkhouses.
Cool.
So they've respected the history of the island right. in a really cool way.
Oh, that's good that whoever bought it had that.
Mm-hmm.
And who knows, maybe it was someone who had been there at some point.
Yeah, I don't think maybe there's a personal connection, but
no.
at least they're quite aware of the history.
Right, and then they appreciate that history
right.
as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's one thing to be aware of it, but I mean, you
right.
could be aware of it and knock it down still,
exactly.
right?
Yeah.
So overall, what would you say the legacy of Grindstone Island is then?
That's my big question.
Right.
It's really, you know, there's no tangible way to say because Grindstone existed, this happened.
Right.
What I can say is that it was a very valuable space for the people who were immersed in the peace movement
mm-hmm.
and later the more broader social justice movement in the cooperative era, that it was such an unusual space and an inviting and engaging space that it gave people an opportunity to reflect on the future, the past, how to improve themselves, what is necessary for social change.
Mm-hmm.
And for the people that I spoke to, some of them continue to be very active today. And they say Grindstone was formative for me in terms of teaching me skills and giving me a community, and it's carried with me my whole life. For other people who have gone on to do other really interesting things, not necessarily having activism at the forefront of their lives, still think back on it as being just a very formative moment, particularly the young people who went as teenagers. As they were taken seriously,
mm-hmm.
they were able to engage in issues that they couldn't have done in their high schools. And it has carried with them as a moment more so. I mean, I think you get these reflections when you think back on a traditional summer camp or other
right,
temporary
yeah,
spaces
yeah, yeah.
that you pass through. But I think it is important for understanding, I guess, going back to the side that education and research mattered in mm-hmm. the peace movement, and that this was a really creative space that was important to people at the time and was a community, this temporary summer community that was a starting point for building relationships and building
right.
ideas.
And for you then personally, the next step in this project, obviously, just in listening to you talk, I mean, you the research goes beyond the one experiment that
right.
you did the Congress paper on.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the hopes with this research?
I'm hoping that it will turn into a book
okay.
that will look at a little bit of the Kingsmill family history, which also included during the Second World War, Second World War, having children come over from Britain to stay on the island as part of sort of the movement of children escaping the Blitz in London, as well as Canadian soldiers and nurses convalescing on Grindstone. So I think understanding the island as a space, which at once was about war, having the Admiral there, but then becoming a place for peace in various ways. And then looking at, I think I see chapters on Canada-US relations, Canada on sort of the intergenerational moments, on experimental learning. So I think as someone who's primarily, I think, a social and political story, I'm trying to understand more environmental history about both what, I guess, the meaning of space and understanding this wild space, tamed space, and what islands mean to people in terms of both its space mythologically, but also practically what it means to be on an island and how that affects organization and changing people's viewpoints too.
Well, yeah, it's a really cool project because it has all those elements to it, and it's, I think, little known, this island. I mean, I'd never heard of it until I saw the title in the program, and by no means am I representative of all Canadians, but, you know, as someone who has studied Canadian history for my whole adult life, that I haven't heard of this, you know, it makes me think that it's probably something that is underappreciated or lesser known in Canadian history, so that despite the fact that it has such an interesting story to go along with it. So it's cool that you're looking into it.
Yeah, thank you.
So we wish you all the best with it and look forward to seeing the progress as it goes forward, whether if this turns into an article or articles along the way, and then hopefully a monograph at the end of this. And like we say, the other book, Cold War Comforts, Canadian Women, Child Safety, Global Insecurity, which was published in 2012, and your entry in Worth Fighting For, which, again, the title of which is The Fasting Granny versus the Trudeau Government, which is just phenomenal. So that's Tara Brookfield from Wilfrid Laurier University, the campus in Brantford, Ontario. Thank you for doing this.
Great. Thank you very much, Sean.
If you have any questions or comments for the podcast, it's historyslam@gmail.com. Twitter is @DrShawneeFever. And if you're out and you see Enrico Palazzo, please say hi for me.
Thanks for listening to the History Slam podcast. Be sure to check out Active History for more features, articles, and be sure to subscribe on iTunes.